In January, Congressman Peter DeFazio toured the state and gave presentations about his views on fast-tracking the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In this hour, we'll hear his forum that was recorded in Eugene. The panel members are Tom Chamberlain of the AFL-CIO, Deborah Higby of the Sierra Club, and University of Oregon political science professor Gordon Lafer. And now, Congressman Peter DeFazio.
Appreciate you all being here tonight. KLCC will be taping. We're here tonight to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and something called Fast-Track Trade Authority. I'll start and try and sort of set the stage. Then we'll get into some of the aspects of the TPP that are particularly egregious. You know, I've been in, I've opposed every free trade agreement in Congress. Some might remember NAFTA. NAFTA was sort of a watershed. It was negotiated under what was called Fast Track. And what Fast Track means is the president negotiates a deal in secret. Then the president signs the deal. And then the president and his staff write the enabling legislation to send to Congress, because these are not treaties. These are trade agreements. So they're voted on by both the House and the Senate. And in the enabling agreement, they change U.S. laws to comply with the trade pact. When the bill comes to Congress, no amendments are allowed, no committee consideration, markup is allowed. The bill has to come to the floor of the House, and it must be voted on within 60 days. No amendments are allowed. It's up or down as presented. And then if both houses vote for it, it's a done deal. Now, the key here is with NAFTA, at that a different time in American history, and a lot of people thought NAFTA was maybe going to be a pretty good deal. The Clinton-Gore administration did a pretty good job of selling it, saying it means 450,000 jobs for U.S. workers. It's going to help people on both sides of the border. It's going to put Americans to work. It's going to help raise the standard of living in Mexico. It was going to be just a great thing. But after it was finished, after the president signed it, after they sent us the enabling legislation, people began to understand what was in it. And what was in it was the core of NAFTA was to protect U.S. capital movement to Mexico, plain and simple. Because Mexico had expropriated Standard Oil in the last century, and our capital-intensive industries were worried, well, if we move to Mexico, yeah, we can get really cheap oppressed labor. Yeah, we can dump stuff out the back door. We don't have to worry about environmental laws. But we're worried about we might get expropriated. So it set up a process, which will be discussed later, but it's called an investor-state dispute resolution process, where a wronged corporation can avoid the Mexican courts, the U.S. courts, and the Canadian courts, in the case of NAFTA, go to a secret tribunal and have their case tried in secret and be decided by trade lawyers in secret. And then it's a binding decision. And the way it works is they fine you. And if you don't pay the fine, then they put tariffs on your goods. I was very involved in this at the time, and I was talking to Mr. Cantor, who was Clinton's special trade representative. And I said, so we're going to bind ourselves to this extrajudicial sort of thing, and they can make us change our laws. He said, no, they can't make us change our laws. And I said, oh, right, you're technically right. We can pay to keep our laws. That's the way this works. And this has actually happened where we have been fined or threatened with fines if we didn't repeal laws. The labeling of dolphin safe tuna, that was repealed. We had a mandatory label that was repealed under threat of sanctions because of NAFTA. We now have a voluntary label for tuna. Mexico has again gone to a secret tribunal to say that we have to pay damages if we don't do that. A corporation in Canada opened a branch in the U.S. because Quebec banned fracking, and they are now suing Canada in an international tribunal because they couldn't go to a Canadian court to try and get $250 million in damages for fracking. So we'll hear more about that. But that was, so as NAFTA unfolded, people began to understand that there were no environmental sections in the bill. There were no labor protections in the bill. This was simply about U.S. capital being able to access Mexican workers who were abused and oppressed and not allowed to organize, and access Mexico's system of non-enforcement of environmental laws or lack of environmental laws. And then there was a huge uproar toward the end. We were organizing hard, and we were going to beat it. We were going to beat NAFTA. And then at the end, Clinton realized he was going down here. So he said, wait a minute. Boy, you're right. Just a little oversight here. I just negotiated an environmental section and a labor protection section. They're side agreements. And the problem was, of course, side agreements are not in the agreement and they're not binding and they weren't in the law he sent to Congress, so they weren't binding. But it gave enough of my Democratic colleagues cover to vote for it, say, oh, well, we're going to get those later. Well, later never came. And so that's how NAFTA got through, and that's why fast track is the most critical part of this. If the president gets fast track trade authority, which was just introduced 10 days ago in Congress, the TPP will probably happen. So I'm trying to get people interested, excited, focused, and for once you got to focus on process, which is a little hard. I mean, we're going to talk about the substance and what will follow the process of fast track and give you plenty of reasons why you should get excited about this and why help us network everywhere we can to raise awareness about this. But fast track is really the key to getting this. The deal is the president's going to Asia in March and they want to vote on fast track in February. So he can sign the agreement in March. And then someone says, well, why would it make a difference? He has fast track. The other 10 countries are parliamentary. So if they sign, the deal's done. There is no contention. We're not. So if the president signs and that comes forward as a regular legislation to Congress, we can change it. We could take out provisions that allow forced child labor in Vietnam and say we're not going to allow those goods in. We could put in environmental sections, but they'd be stuck with, and they cut a deal, which because there's some really evil stuff in there that the U.S. wants that relates to pharmaceuticals and Wall Street and a whole bunch of other interests that they're stuck with that they didn't really want, but they're getting something they really want. So we could take and continue to protect Wall Street and the pharmaceutical companies and take out what they needed. So that's why fast track's the key. So I'm going to turn now to Tom Chamberlain, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. He'll give a broad perspective from workers. Then we'll go up to environment, and then we'll go over and we will focus on this investor state, which is really the beating evil heart of this whole thing.
Thank you, Congressman DeFazio, and thank you for being a champion on this issue. Opponents of the Trans-Pacific Partnership often refer to the partnership as NAFTA on steroids, and supporters suggest that's not a bad thing. I'd like to explain just what the effect of NAFTA has been, though, not for the corporations whose bottom lines are used to determine the health of our economy, but for those workers in our communities like this one, whose paychecks and savings and retirement accounts more accurately depict our economic well-being. In 2011, the U.S. trade deficit with our NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico, was over $100 billion. That's billion with a B. You see, between 1994, when NAFTA was implemented, and 2011, when these trade deficits occurred, Oregon lost 4,000 jobs in the logging industry. They lost 20,000 jobs in the forest products industry. That's a 50% drop in just one industry in Oregon. While the loss cannot be fully contributed to NAFTA, that steep decline was tied directly to Canadian wood products being dumped into the United States. A similar picture can be painted for other industries across Oregon. Let's just get to the TPP. It has three threats to Oregon. One, it increases trade with developed countries, which find non-tariff means to block Oregon products. It increases trade with developing countries whose workers who can afford lower paychecks because their cost of living is lower. And it undermines our state's ability to regulate our economy at the cost of workers and consumers. The U.S. has a growing trade deficit with Japan without any trade agreements. Pro-free trade experts suggest that the TPP will lower those barriers and allow more U.S. exports to Japan, creating more balanced trade. A similar assertion was made before we signed the trade agreement with South Korea. In 2011, the U.S. had a trade deficit with South Korea of $14 billion. When the trade agreement was signed in 2012, it was $18 billion. Today, it's $25 billion, the highest rate we've ever had. As tariffs fell with South Korea, they found other ways to protect their goods, increasing their access to our market while restricting our access to theirs. The U.S. currently has relatively balanced trade with less developed countries who would be involved in the TPP. We can see trade deficits skyrocket as U.S. businesses are given easier and easier access to markets with lower cost of living, where workers can afford to earn less than Oregon does. Our exports are primarily raw materials, agriculture products, metals, raw wood, products that are easy to manufacture at far less cost in our TPP partner countries. Oregon is on the West Coast, with ports facing our potential partners, and with an economic makeup forecast on unfinished goods and technical service, it's uniquely positioned to gain jobs in the shipping industries, but lose jobs in the manufacturing industries, where we maintain a good solid middle class. The TPP is a lose-lose. It's a loss for the workers, it's a loss for consumers, it's a loss for our economy. The only way we're going to turn this around, the only way we're going to stop this, is to get on the phone, call your senators, call Senator Wyden, call Senator Merkley. You don't have to call this congressman, but call them in their Salem office, their Portland office, call the president, have your friends call. We have to have a grassroots game here to turn this around. You have to make it more painful to support Fast Track than not to support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Congressman DeFazio. My name is Deborah Higby-Sudica, and I'm with the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club has grave concern about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and strongly opposes fast-track legislation that would remove the ability of Congress to ensure trade pacts protect the public and the environment. So why is the TPP so significant, you might ask? It will potentially impact every aspect of our lives. The TPP is a huge pact that would govern about 40% of the world's gross domestic product and one-third of world trade. Today I'm going to offer a few comments about how the TPP would harm the environment and then speak about the impacts of Fast Track. First, I want to say a bit about the process. The TPP has been negotiated in virtually unprecedented secrecy. Still not a word of draft text or even U.S. proposals has been publicly released, except, of course, leaked. Despite the fact that the pact has been under negotiation for 4 years and may be concluded in the next few months, the public and the media, and until recently, even members of Congress, have been completely shut out of the process. Those involved in the process are 600 industry representatives who are official advisors to the United States Trade Representative, who is the part of the U.S. government that negotiates trade agreements. Those who care about the climate and energy implications of these pacts don't need to look any farther for trouble than the list of energy advisors to the U.S. Trade Representative, which includes Halliburton, Chevron, GE, National Coal Council, and others who make up the biggest fossil fuel corporations in the world. Those who will profit from TPP want you to believe that it'll enhance trade and investment, promote innovation, economic growth, and development, and support the creation and retention of jobs. However, the TPP is less about trade and more about deregulation of the Pacific Rim economy and providing super rights to corporations. This trade deal has been called NAFTA on steroids, although I believe what it should be called is a corporation super rights and deregulation deal. Maybe if we call it by its right name, it'll get people's attention. Getting to the substance, there are 29 TPP chapters. From the Sierra Club's perspective, one of the most dangerous chapters of the TPP is the investment chapter. You might have thought it was the environment chapter, but the investment chapter has provisions that give corporate polluters new rights at a time when we need to be reining in their power. The investment chapter of TPP would give corporations the right to sue governments in private trade tribunals for unlimited cash compensation over laws and policies the corporations allege reduce their profits. This would make them more powerful than governments, replacing policy with rules the corporations write. For a cautionary tale of what tribunals can do, Congressman DeFazio talked about fracking in Quebec. Using rules similar to the TPP, corporations have launched more than 500 cases against 95 governments. Approximately 60% of the time, the corporation wins. There's also another cautionary tale is nuclear energy in Germany. The German parliament made a decision to phase out its nuclear power program and shift towards cleaner renewables. Vattenfall, a Swedish energy firm with investments in German nuclear energy, sued Germany for future losses that it may sustain during the nuclear phase-out. Vattenfall is seeking $4.6 billion damages from the German people. This means practically any new law or regulation in the U.S., even right here in Oregon, like new limits on greenhouse gas emissions, new regulations on fracking, could be challenged as a result of the TPP. Again, this would give super rights to foreign investors like big oil, big pharma, Wall Street investors. This will go far beyond our domestic constitutional protections for property rights and due process in the United States. The United States already favors property rights and corporate rights more than any other country in the world. The TPP would also increase natural gas exports and therefore fracking across the United States. And the reason why this is so, the TPP would require the United States to automatically approve all exports of gas to countries in the agreement, including Japan, the biggest natural gas importer. The Sierra Club has been opposing LNG exports for good reason. Number one, LNG exports would expand fracking in the United States in order to feed foreign markets. More fracking means more toxic chemicals in our land and water, more health risk to communities. Living in the areas close to fracking, more hazardous smog-forming and climate-altering pollutants into our air. Number two, LNG exports are also terrible for our climate. There are tremendous greenhouse gas implications with cooling, liquefying, transporting, and regasifying gas. And number three, it'll lock us into more fossil fuel investments and infrastructure at a time when we should be investing in clean energy. As you may have heard last week, the draft environment chapter of the TPP was leaked. The overarching problem with the environment chapter is that there is no enforcement. It is supposedly intended to help ensure that more trade does not put pressure on scarce natural resources of the Pacific Rim, like our forests, fish, and wildlife. Unfortunately, the leaked text is extremely weak and completely unenforceable and will actually serve to exacerbate damage to the environment and biodiversity of the Pacific Rim. It doesn't take strong enough stance against illegal wildlife products like ivory, elephant ivory, tiger pelts, and shark fins. It doesn't go far enough to prevent illegal logging. It doesn't discourage overfishing. The 12 countries negotiating the TPP account for one-third of global fisheries production, so the stakes are very high. These countries need to phase out harmful subsidies that lead to greater harvesting of fish than is sustainable. Last week, Michael Bruin, executive director of the Sierra Club, said that if the environment chapter is finalized as written in this leaked document, President Obama's environmental record would be worse than George W. Bush's. So now there's fast track. Fast track legislation would remove the ability of Congress to ensure that trade pacts like the TPP protect communities and the environment. It would allow the president to sign the agreement and then give the Congress just an up and down vote, kind of a rubber stamp. The Sierra Club strongly opposes fast track, and we call on members of our Congress to reject it as well. So to conclude, we urgently need a new model of trade that works for, not against, communities and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative DeFazio, for the invitation to be here. My name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a political science professor and a professor at the Labor Education Research Center of the U of O. And I think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is probably the single most important thing happening in Congress now, and amazing that almost nobody knows anything about it. I want to be clear that being against the TPP is not being against trade per se. Historically, there are two broad models for how to do trade, and those are NAFTA and the European Union in the beginning. Both of them, especially when the European Union started, confronted the problem of how to integrate rich economies with poor economies. For us, it was the U.S. and Canada integrating with Mexico. For them, it was countries like Germany, Denmark, France, with Portugal, Spain, and Greece, which especially then in the 1970s were much, much poorer than the northern countries. And the different ways is that what the Europeans did, the European model,
was, along with an economic law, they passed the European Social Charter. They said, the poor countries, Portugal, Spain, Greece, you have to raise your minimum wage. You have to raise your equivalent of Social Security. You have to provide more health insurance. You have to invest more in infrastructure and in schools. And because of that, within the European Union, not just money, not just business can cross borders, but people can cross borders. You think, why is it that even now nobody is afraid that all of Portugal is going to move to Paris or Berlin? Is because their vision of integrating rich and poor economies is to raise up the floor and to make the poorer companies better off. The way we did it in NAFTA, which has then become the model for the WTO and now for the TPP, is to do nothing. We didn't require anything of Mexico. You don't have to raise your minimum wage. You don't have to have real labor laws. You don't have to invest in anything. And then by the natural working of normal competitive economy, the U.S. and Canada slowly got bid down and competed down, and we saw jobs leaving. One of the interesting things about NAFTA is Gallup does a poll every year where they ask people in all three countries, U.S., Canada, and Mexico, which country do you think won and which country do you think was the loser from NAFTA? And every year, a majority of people in all three countries think their country was the loser. And the reason is that these treaties are done really to benefit the elite in all countries and to the detriment of the majority of working people in all three countries. It's not really a question of everybody in one country wins and one loses. The elite win in all countries, but it's bad for the people in all countries. For us, here in the U.S., we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since NAFTA, particularly since we normalized trade relations with China. Oregon alone has lost 50,000 manufacturing jobs. And these are just the jobs that the federal government certified as being lost due to foreign trade. So now they say, let's do another one, this time with Vietnam and Malaysia and a bunch of other Pacific Rim countries. So there are many problems with this. The single biggest problem that other people have spoken about is something called investor-state dispute resolution. And the way this works is two things. First of all, when a company invests in a foreign country, one of the things they're always concerned about is, could there be a political change and my investment gets expropriated? When we think of expropriation, most people think of physically taking something. Like Castro said, these casinos don't belong to you, who are, you know, the mafia, whoever they belong to in 1959. We're taking them now, and we're taking the oil fields, and we're taking whatever else we're taking. Right? So companies understandably are concerned, if I invest someplace, I don't want to have my assets confiscated. But since the Central American Free Trade Agreement under George W. Bush, the trade agreements, including the TPP, have changed the definition of expropriation to now say we need to protect investors against indirect expropriation, which means anything that would reduce investors' reasonable expectation of gain or profit, right? So to be clear how extreme this is, and this is why the evil beating heart it is, Portland passed a law mandating that everybody has a right to a certain minimum number of days of paid sick leave. There are people who think we should pass a law like that statewide. If we pass TPP, it is quite conceivable that we'd have a foreign company that invests in Oregon, and then we pass a law saying, hey, everybody in Oregon is entitled to a minimum of 5 days of paid sick leave. And that company says, wait a minute. When we invested, we had a reasonable expectation of a certain profit rate that was based on not having to pay anybody sick leave. If you want to pass a right to paid sick leave, knock yourselves out, but you're going to have to reimburse us for the cost of eating into our reasonable expectation of profit. Right? So this is when people say, oh, it doesn't really take away your sovereignty. Technically, it doesn't. In fact, what it does is it makes it unaffordable to pass any law that affects profit. And what affects profit is an enormous amount of things. There's a second principle in these treaties, including in TPP, which says no domestic company can be treated any better than any foreign company. So for one thing, any Buy American laws become illegal. Any attempts to say you can't export whole logs from Oregon, a certain amount of the work of turning logs into wood products has to be done within the state, becomes illegal. But there's even more extreme things under NAFTA, under what's called investor-state dispute resolution. For the first time ever, a company, a corporation, can sue a government, not a government suing a government. Now, for workers' rights, only a government can sue another government, and it's a 12-step process with no time limits that's all voluntary, and there has never, ever been a fine for any country for violating labor rights under any of our trade agreements. But the investor rights, the foreign company sues a government directly, and they do it in a private tribunal, which is created under the treaty, which is not accountable to any democratically elected body, not to any court, not subject to appeal. It is final, binding, and unappealable. Okay? And it is also secret, and it is non-precedential, which means they decide something one way, they don't necessarily have to decide the next thing the same way. So here are some examples of what kind of things have happened, and these are under NAFTA. The ban on supporting domestic industries. Mexico has a big sugarcane industry that employed 300,000 people directly and another 2 million people in related jobs, and they had a tax on non-sugar sweeteners. Archer Daniels Midland sued them because they wanted to import high fructose corn syrup into Mexico, and they said, this is unfair. You have a tax that unfairly advantages your domestic sugar industry over us, a party to the treaty, and they won. And Mexico had to stop their tax on non-sugar sweeteners and pay Archer Daniels Midland $30 million and lay off who knows how many people. Jobs got destroyed. A second example, Canada had a prohibition which was in concert with the Basel Convention, an international accord that banned the transport of PCBs, of toxic substances, across international borders, which the Basel Convention says you shouldn't do because whenever you transport toxic stuff across the border, the risk of a spill is heightened. So there was a company called S.D. Myers in the U.S., and their business is processing toxic waste. And they said, this is unfair. By having a law prohibiting transportation across the border, you're giving a monopoly to Canadian companies on the business of taking this toxic waste and turning it into a product that they can sell. And they sued Canada and won, and Canada had to pay them $5 million and allow things to be transported across the border. Another case that I think is scary and feels like sci-fi, this case did not win. It lost on a technicality, but we don't know if it would happen in the future. UPS sued Canada Post in British Columbia, not about delivering letters, but about delivering parcels. They said Canada Post gets a big budget from the provincial government of BC every year, and we're in the same business. And that's not fair. That's an unfair subsidy to favor a domestic company. You need to either cut off your funding for Canada Post parcel service or give us, UPS, the same budget that you give Canada Post. Now, they lost on a technicality, but because this is not precedential, a similar case could easily happen. I mean, you can imagine anything. You could have Singapore open a university here, and maybe they don't care about English. They just want to teach the high-dollar things. They'll teach business and sports marketing. And they'll say, Oregon, you need to give us the same budget that you give the University of Oregon or cut off your funding for the University of Oregon because that's what's fair. You can't treat a domestic organization differently than you treat us. So we could end up with a lot of forced privatization. The last example I want to give you is something that died stillborn. This was in the province of New Brunswick. New Brunswick looked at auto insurance, and they thought that their auto insurance rates were inflated. And they developed an idea basically for a public option auto insurance. They said, we're going to have car insurance, an option. Nobody has to buy it. The province will run it, and it'll cost 20% less than the next most expensive thing on the market. And that way, we'll make car insurance more affordable for everybody. An American insurance company threatened to sue them, said, we'll take you to tribunal under NAFTA because this unfairly creates a monopoly and doesn't allow American insurance companies to compete on the same basis. And the law was killed before it ever got through the provincial legislature because they knew that they would lose, right? So insurance rates remain 20% above where they have to be. So this is to give you some idea of the incredible scope of things that are subject to investor-state dispute resolution. Let me just say, I started at the beginning saying, like, you don't have to be against trade. There is another model. One of them is called the Trade Act. Trade is some acronym that I forget, trade, reform, accountability, something. A majority of Democrats in the Congress have signed on to it, and it says we want to do trade treaties with other countries, but we want to do them under certain principles. One of those principles is to not have investor-state dispute resolution, to do away with that. So one of the novel things about the TPP is that it's written in a way that allows other countries to sign on in the future, which means we may inadvertently be drafting a treaty with China. If China says, okay, I agree to those terms, they can come in. Various other countries can come in down the road. The Doha round of the WTO, which was stopped in 1999 in Seattle, maybe there were some people in this room, there were a lot of people from Eugene who were there, in 1999 was stopped by protesters and has never been concluded ever since, for whatever that is, 15 years almost, because of people being in the streets all over the place. One of the things that is remarkable about the TPP is that if you ask people, should we have more free trade agreements with countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, it's tremendously unpopular across the political spectrum. It's the people who are the most negative about the idea of the TPP are not liberal Democrats from Eugene, they're self-identified Tea Party members. And basically, both parties' leadership are hiding this from their base. You'll never hear Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or John Boehner out in public shouting, hey, we need a new NAFTA-style agreement with Vietnam and Malaysia, although that's what they're doing, because they need the deal to go down in quiet. And it's the job of the people in this room to make enough noise and shine enough light on it that it can't go down in quiet. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. That was a fabulous presentation. Just a couple of quick points building on that. And I'll start with your last point. We've been organizing against fast track because we knew it was coming for this entire Congress. And we got 151 Democrats and 27 Republicans to publicly sign letters saying they're not going to support fast track. That means we're at 178. We need 218. But that's just publicly. There are other members who are very much on the fence. There are others who are leaning our way, but they're just hoping it won't come to be and they won't have to deal with it because there's a tremendous amount on the other side of the issue. We have corporations in Oregon that are lobbying very fiercely for this up near Portland, Intel, Nike, and others. So some members just hope they'll never be put on that spot and have to make that choice. But we've got to encourage them to take a position and say, look, I'd love to look at a large-scale trade agreement, but let's bring it forward in regular order. Let Congress decide whether we want to allow in goods that are made with forced child labor. Let Congress decide if we want to have environmental provisions in here. Like, these are things that we should take a position on. Just a few things that are in the TPP that are explicit. He talked about things that we fully expect will unfold with investor state. There are several things that are explicit. One that's explicit is it's a huge win for the pharmaceutical industry in the United States. They are part and parcel of the big powers behind this. They get two major things out of this in the intellectual property section. One is that they can challenge any country that has a formulary to purchase drugs for their citizens. That's in the agreement. And in fact, it would force countries to change their formularies. They could be challenged. Now, the vulnerability they've created here, and I have this from an expert trade lawyer, is it isn't just New Zealand's formulary, which would be tremendously controversial. It already is in New Zealand, Australia, or some of these other countries where the people have to pay more for drugs or the government's going to pay a lot more for drugs. It actually affects us here at home. The government negotiates lower drug prices for veterans, and they get the lowest drug prices of anybody in this country, and we save a lot of money, and we do a lot of good for our vets. That would be challengeable. That would be, under this agreement, that's challengeable, as is Medicaid. We also get the biggest discount next to the VA for Medicaid drugs, the lowest price that those pharmaceutical companies charge to any insurance company they have to give us for Medicaid drugs in this country. That is challengeable explicitly under the TPP. So pharmaceuticals a big winner. The same expert has told me that she believes that this agreement would preempt my transaction tax on Wall Street. It would be violative. We couldn't pass a transaction tax on financial speculation under this agreement. So that's a big win for Wall Street because they're starting to get worried about my transaction tax because 11 countries in Europe have adopted it and they're going to implement it next year. So they're worried it might come here too. So that's extraordinary. And then she also believes it would allow them to challenge the pretty minimal reforms we got in Dodd-Frank and go back to the good old days of 2007 with the rampant speculation on Wall Street. So those things are all explicit. Those are some things we don't know. As was mentioned, this agreement has been secretly negotiated. A few chapters have been leaked. I could observe the agreement if I wished. They will bring it to my office with guards, and they will sit in and watch me look at it. I can't take notes. I can't copy it, obviously. I can't have staff in the room to discuss it with. And afterwards, I can't talk explicitly about what I read, because it's considered to be a classified document. Classified documents, a national security document. And when Ron Kirk, the former trade representative in one rather candid moment when he was on his way out. Someone said, well, why is it secret? And he said, well, the American people wouldn't like what was in there if they saw it. And nor would, I think, a lot of the elected representatives and the American people. This could be the last trade agreement. And that point was just made. This could be the last one because it is a new, novel idea. It is a living trade agreement that anybody can agree to and sign up for. And former Special Trade Representative Kirk said, we're thrilled that China wants to sign up. Just imagine that. And just think of it, the Vietnamese government, communist government, Chinese government, communist government, they control corporations there. Their corporations there, controlled by a communist government, can challenge the laws of the United States in a secret tribunal staffed by trade attorneys who alternate between representing corporations and making judgments. Now, whose side do you think they come down on for their future employment? These are things that people, I mean, they just think I'm kind of like, you're making that up. I'm not making these things up. These are very, very real. Finally, on one other issue that I've been working on since I got to Congress, mining reform. We're living under the 1872 mining law. Ulysses S. Grant signed it. It's an abomination, and we have huge threats in southern Oregon with nickel mining coming up. And our largest mining corporations, the two largest mining operations on federal lands in the United States of America, are foreign corporations. So if I ever was successful, and we have twice passed mining reform in the House, not this House, not these Republicans, but when the Democrats were in charge, and it was stalled in the Senate, if we get back to a point of actually passing it again and sending it to the president and getting it into law, those corporations would have a right to say, well, you're going to put all these new restrictions on what we do with our waste and how we operate and all that. Pay us, and we'll comply, or change your law. So this is inimical. I was asked by someone from the Daily Emerald, like, how would this affect students? And I said, well, you know, if you care about the environment, wow. If you care about human rights, that's something. And if you care about your future employability, because that's the other thing. What this will do to job opportunities in this country would be absolutely devastating. It's already been devastating with the current trade agreements, and this one would make it worse.
I believe it's time to step up the game in a rhetoric. These are earth-shattering economic models. They're devastating and ruinous on a number of levels. It's time to call this what it is. It's time to bring out the F word. It is fascism. This is economic fascism. We don't need to be afraid of that term. And the reason I bring this up is because these people don't listen to reason or common sense. They don't care about that. They want this to be hush-hush. They need to be shamed and embarrassed. That is just one tactic. And what I mean is perhaps groups like Sierra Club, other groups, full one-page ads, unions can contribute, and call this what it is. Let's stop the economic fascism. And many people, I'm sure, would say, that will turn people off. That they'll shun that. But what they will do is read the bullet points when they see that and go, my God, fascism, what is this? They're going to read that and look at those bullet points you've been giving us. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to fight at a different level, and on all levels. And that's just my 10 cents.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Gregory Rose. I want first to thank you, Congressman, for your heroic work in opposing these monstrous trade agreements and the use of an arbitrary Nixon-esque tactic to ram it through the American Congress without appropriate scrutiny. There is, however, an issue which you haven't talked about, which I think is important. If you will look at the countries which are involved in the TPP, you will notice the conspicuous absence of countries associated with the Bolivarian revolutionary movement in Latin America. Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Brazil are specifically excluded from it, while more right-wing regimes in Latin America are encouraged. You'll note also that Brazil and these countries are involved with the BRICS movement, with Russia and India and China. And I think it is possible to conceive of TPP as an attempt to either force these countries into line or to deny them any sort of privileged access to the markets of the TPP countries. Also, if you look at the Communist Party's Congress last year, even though some Chinese officials have talked favorably about TPP, the resolutions of the Party Congress were very negative and saw TPP as an attempt to economically isolate China and reduce its trade with the rest of the world. And I think both views that this is directed against more leftist regimes in Latin America and against China are reasonable hypotheses, given the fact that this is pressed in an environment of, by and large, right-wing regimes who are committed to austerity policies for the sake of international capital.
Okay, thank you. Anyone want to comment on that? Or we can move on. Next.
Hi, I'm Jane Kramer, and I just wanted to point out that I'm pro-free trade, but in the model that Professor Lafer was pointing out, that works for people. And I do believe that this, you know, Obama's doing two things here. He says he's for reducing inequality and hopefully raising a minimum wage. Am I wrong? This is the end of the minimum wage. Foreign corporations could get compensated, while domestic corporations wouldn't get compensated, right? If we raise the minimum wage, we would have to pay the difference in the wages, right?
In the future, yeah. I think that could happen. But we haven't seen the text, right? And they always say, they sometimes say, oh, we're going to carve out things that are critical, health and safety issues, but nobody's seen the text to know, well, what would be carved out, and certainly the history is that labor standards have never been treated in that way. Oh, well, there is a process for filing a complaint about a country not obeying labor law. It is a 12-step process. At each step, there is no time limit, and it's voluntary, and since NAFTA, there have been many complaints, there's never been a single fine issued under that.
Tom said it's very fitting, it's 12 steps, so. But they're not reforming. Unfortunately, they're not reforming, Tom. Yes?
I want to know where our elected officials are for standing up for the sovereignty of the United States. We have our own laws. There's no reason, and it's against the rule of law, to say, oh, you can no longer enforce your own laws. That's absurd. And these things are already in place, and it's going to get worse from any indication that we can get from what's leaked about the TPP. So I'm just wondering, who's going to stand up? I want to know. All of these people sitting here, what are we going to do to stand up for our sovereignty?
Thank you. I don't have the bold move, but we can start with a simple grassroots move. There's quite a few people here. I don't know how many Facebook contacts you all have or how many people you're otherwise linked to. But if you got every one of them to join you in sending emails and tweeting and calling your representatives, particularly here in Oregon, or if they're from other states, their representatives, I mean, that kind of a thing can grow pretty quickly into a massive movement. And that's why I chose to do these things when I was home in this break, because we don't have much time. And we've got to start with a grassroots movement. We've got to expose what's at risk here, which most people don't know. So, yes, sir, go ahead.
My name is Tawasi. I'm an internet activist, being a person who also comes to direct actions. My understanding of the TPP is that it would restrict internet access and restrict the freedom of speech on the internet. Is that a fair?
You remember those two bills proposed in the last Congress that internet activists were able to educate people on and cause a tremendous reaction and make Congress back off? Things like that are very probable. Under the intellectual property section, we don't have the official text, but what's in there looks bad for internet freedom. And also, since we just had that bad court decision on net neutrality, we got a lot at risk here.
Okay. Michael Kerrigan, Community Alliance, Elaine County. Is there going to be a coordinated campaign statewide so we can be really effective in stopping this? So will it be like one statewide office or some way where we can really do the best job we can?
By the first part of next week, there'll be on our website, there'll be links that you can link into your congressman
And so go to our website, just do a search for the Oregon AFL-CIO, and the numbers will be there, and we'll get you there.
I just want to say that, you know, for anybody here who wants to make a presentation about this to your friends or neighbors or church or whatever you want, I am happy to send you, if you think they'd be useful, these PowerPoint slides and the notes that accompany them that explain the slides. My name is Gordon Lafer. You can find me on the University of Oregon directory. If you email me, I will send this to everybody. I mean, you could call it whatever you want, but it's not rocket science. It's shocking, but it's not rocket science to explain this to other people, and that seems to me the most powerful thing we can do. So I'll share this to anybody who wants. GLAFER at uoregon.edu. And if you forget, just look up on the U of O directory.
Next. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Graham Lewis. And you've been mentioning quite a few specifics about the TPP, and yet you're saying that it's not available for you to look at. So other than WikiLeaks, where do you get your information?
Lori Wallach with Public Citizen has gotten some leaked chapters separate from WikiLeaks, some of which she has analyzed and summarized on her website. She's done probably the best work on this that I know of. So she's another good source. They were leaked to her by sympathetic negotiators from countries who aren't happy about many of the provisions in here and feel it's going to be against the interests of their people. So, but we're getting very selective leaks because there are chapters that will benefit some of these countries that will be potentially to the detriment of things we believe in. So we don't know. At this point, I think four have been leaked, and two are on WikiLeaks, and Lori has two. So,
and the second part is, what kind of a time frame do we have before the fast track is passed? How many days or weeks do we have?
Well, they do not yet have a Democratic sponsor in the House. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been organizing for over a year against this. I mentioned the number of people have signed up. What I didn't mention is we've got a whip organization among Tea Party Republicans who are opposed to this. So some of them are going to be motivated because they're concerned about the Constitution, some of them about our sovereignty, some of them just because they really don't like this president. I don't care why, as if they're voting no on it. So that's kind of the universe we're working on, and we're trying to keep the Democrats, and thus far we have kept any Democrat from being a sponsor of Fast Track in the House. And until they pick someone off and someone prominent to do that, I don't believe they'll bring the bill forward, because that sends a signal that this is probably going to get virtually no Democrat votes. I mean, their top Democratic vote is probably 40, but out of 190. But right now it's zero. So we just got to encourage people to hold strong. Their targets are Sandy Levin from Michigan, just in case anybody knows anyone from Michigan. Sandy is someone they're courting, and what they're courting him with is, you can put in all the meaningless hortatory language you want that isn't binding about negotiating these agreements. We'll put in anything you want about labor, anything you want about domestic production and protecting, and Buy America. We'll put anything you want in that, of course, it won't be binding, but we'll put it in language, and then you can vote for it. Just the way Clinton did with the non-binding labor and environment side agreements, where he got Democrats to cross over. And then their other target is probably Steny Hoyer, on our whip from Maryland. So, but they both at this point have heard a lot, and we've brought this up in caucus meetings. They've heard a lot about it, and nobody's on it. And we're going to keep pushing that hard. So, yes, ma'am.
Loretta Houston. This is probably another one of the most terrifying nightmares we're facing. Who is responsible for this? Do we have any information of who is pushing this? Who is keeping you hostage to this secrecy?
Well, I've got to say, this has been every trade agreement that's come along has been done essentially in this manner, the worst ones, NAFTA and the WTO. And it unfortunately hasn't differed. Reagan started us down this track. Bush One continued us down it. Clinton, unfortunately, with a Republican Congress, implemented the NAFTA and the WTO. And I think when he passed NAFTA, maybe we still had the majority. We got a vast majority of Democrats to vote against it. but we lost enough with almost all the Republicans to pass it, and then the WTO was when the Republicans were in charge of Congress. So it hasn't changed. The Office of the Special Trade Representative is a rotating door among corporations, and people just come through there, all their staff comes through there, and then they go back out in the corporate world, and they come back through. It's sort of like this little entity that exists, and presidents seem beholden to it. And someone asked me last night about President Obama. I said, I did. I've been part of the Fair Trade Working Group. Our bill we have was mentioned earlier on how you might do trade right. And the president did grant us an audience. He had 12 of us down there, and we raised a lot of what we're talking about here tonight. And I got to say, the Special Trade Representative was in the room and arguing those things, you know, not true. And I don't think the president really has a very strong understanding of what's at risk in this agreement or what's in it. And that's why I want people to direct also comments to the White House so that their switchboard melts down and their computers freeze up. And, you know, and the president says, why is that happening? They say, well, because, you know, a million people tried to contact us in the last 24 hours about this TPP thing. Then he might ask tougher questions about it.
I'm Mark Bautista. The one thing that I haven't heard anybody talk about is how does a country opt out of a trade agreement, and has anybody ever said we want to opt out?
Yes.
And if we can opt out, why don't we opt out?
Okay. It's a great question. I've got to tell you, I don't know if the TPP has an opt-out provision. We don't know that. We haven't seen that section. We don't know where it might be in the agreement. There is an opt-out in NAFTA. We can notify Mexico and Canada that we want out with 6 months' notice, or we can notify them with 6 months' notice we want to sit down and renegotiate the agreement. And in the WTO, there's a once every 5 years, we're allowed a vote in Congress to withdraw from the WTO. And we've done that twice since I've been there. I think the first time we got 60-something votes. The second time we got over 100 votes. I worked with Ron Paul on that. We're talking again, Tea Party, strange bedfellows, but Ron was very good on these issues. And I don't know about the TPP. I really don't know. I don't see how, if Congress adopts a law that implements it and we're bound by it, it boggles my mind that a future Congress couldn't just repeal that law and get us out. But I'm not certain. Do you have anything? Yeah. So I don't know until we see the agreement and see the provisions for withdrawal, if there are any.
Hello, my name is Facilia. I'm kind of confused as to like how this is actually like possible. Like, how can they negotiate something so privately if it has so many implications worldwide, and especially in like pretty much everywhere in our country, as you've been saying? Like, and if what you've been saying is true, how they can sort of come up with all this stuff and nobody really knows what's going on?
Well, I think I mentioned at the beginning that this special Congress ceding all its authority to the president on trade agreements has only applied in 5 out of the last 19 years, and I think the first use was back in the Nixon era, wasn't it? The first use, I think, was a Nixon model, and we know what how he was for the populace. So we have negotiated most of our trade agreements outside of this, and most of them are not so egregious, although some of them are still pretty bad. And Tom mentioned Korea. He didn't get specific, but here's what happens is they confuse people. And first they'll sell it that this is going to be great for our economy. It's going to put a lot of people to work. You know, you're young. When you go to college, you're going to want to get out and get a great job. And America can compete. And, of course, we all feel America can compete. And they spin it as though that's what these agreements are about. We're going to create a level playing field. But if you look at the history of everyone, we had a trade surplus with Mexico before NAFTA. Now it's a huge deficit. We had a small deficit with Canada. Now we have a huge deficit. We had a pretty small, but not that big of a deficit with China before we allowed them most a special status so they could join the WTO, so they could be in a larger trade agreement with us. Huge deficit now. And in Korea, here's the way they spun it. All these jobs. It's going to be great. Well, and they say now it's working. And I say, how's it working? They say, well, auto exports are up 50% to Korea. You can't tell me this agreement isn't working. And I go,
Yeah, but before the agreement, we exported 5,000 autos to Korea, and now it's 7,500. But under the agreement, their exports to the U.S. have gone up by almost 300,000 autos. So the net is a loss. They only talk about one side of the ledger. They say they will go through every one of these agreements and say, look, our exports are up. Our exports are up. What you've got to do is subtract the imports into the U.S. from the exports to find out the net effect on the economy. They never do that. They never represent it that way. So they're basically hoodwinking people is what it's about. And there's enough members of Congress, for whatever reason, willing to go along with the charade, and it is a charade, that this stuff can ever work the way it's constructed to the benefit of the American people as opposed to just the few who control the corporations or own stock in them. I mean, that's what it's about.
The Socialist Party parliamentary delegation in Chile has asked the newly elected socialist president in Chile, Ms. Bachelet, to withdraw, and they are putting before the Chilean parliament a resolution to withdraw their approval of TPP. So it is...
Yeah, well, I don't think they've approved it yet, but they would withdraw from the negotiation. Yes. The other example, which is interesting, and I know Gordon knows this, one country participating in this said, we will not be subject to our laws to challenges by corporations, and that was Australia. But they just recently had the Conservatives take over, so whether that'll still stand or not. But right now they're saying, we'll sign, but we don't sign on, you can't have investor state with us, which is something extraordinary.
Why can't we create a constitutional amendment to protect the people against such agreements, and why can't we keep it a secret to these companies who would find it as we create it?
Well, I was on in the last Congress four different constitutional amendments to modify, overturn, or fully reverse Citizens United. Not a one of them ever had a hearing in the House. It's a steep cliff, but it's a great idea. So if we could reverse the tables on the corporation. Okay, thanks very much. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You just heard a forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement with Congressman Peter DeFazio. The panelists were Tom Chamberlain of the AFL-CIO, Deborah Higbee of the Sierra Club, and University of Oregon political science professor Gordon Lafer. This program was recorded at the University of Oregon in Eugene on January 22, 2014. For more information, visit Congressman DeFazio's website at defazio.house.gov. I'm Matt Laubach for KLCC. Thank you for listening.